This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you an hour of short stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to an hour of short stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. Our authors today are Hungarian Károly Kisfaldy, who was born in the 18th century, and Londoner Ronald Chetwin Hayes, who lived into the 21st century. Hungarian author Károly Kisfaldy lived from 1788 to 1830. Today's Republic of Hungary, which is a member of NATO and the European Union, is a far cry from the time of Kisfaldy, when serfdom still existed. It happened that my regiment had been stationed near Lake Como, and it was from here that we went to meet the French in support of the threatened left wing of the Divardi Brigade, and there it was that my friend the Major bit the dust. We had a lovely and lively time in the small town near Lake Como for several months, for the Italian women enjoyed the company of our hussars, and each and every one of us could count our successes by the dozens among the passionate and lovely signorinas. My friend the Major was perhaps the only exception, as far as I knew. He was of the more serious-minded and melancholy type, who fell in love with women and wanted to marry them, instead of having a gay time with one and then begin with the next one. The Major was made of different stuff. He fell in love with a young girl the second day we spent there, and he would stare up at her window at night while the rest of us scattered all over the town to keep rendezvous and drink to the health of the most beautiful women in the world. The Major was in love, and no doubt his passion found proper response on the part of the lovely young lady. That we could hardly doubt, for the Major was the finest, the best-looking, and the most companionable fellow amongst the score of officers. We also knew that the favor he had found with the object of his ideal was not shared at all by her honorable parents. Those were not the time for matrimonial affairs. A soldier was a roving vagabond and not destined for family life, especially a foreign soldier who might be in one country today and at the other end of the world tomorrow. One really could not blame the parents for not being enthusiastic over his suit. Our morals, too, were rather of the loose sort, soldierly morals, so to say. When love did not particularly demand the sanction of the church, at least not on the part of hussars in a foreign land, even allowing for the fact that we had to deal with an allied nation. All is fair in war and love. We urged him to take what he could, and I am reasonably certain he would not have hesitated had the girl not been exacting in the observance of etiquette and moral standards. But she was. It was of no avail to explain to her that love has its own rewards. She insisted that he marry her, and that she would be only too happy to become his wife. He would have done so, if even for a day, but the girl never had the chance to be alone with him long enough to consult a priest, let alone to get married in secret. It was a hopeless case, and the Major was dejected and more melancholy than ever. He never took part at our carousings and lively parties. He accepted no invitations from many exclusive families whose homes we frequented, but spent most of his time at the Fioria mansion under the chaperonage of the old lady, and he could not even hold his fair one's hand in secret or whisper passionate words of love to her. now and then only could they exchange a few words, when they chanced to dance together, or when the old lady's attention was called to something more important than guarding of the girl's honor. Several months passed, and the major had made no headway at all. The old people, however, noticed that the girl's infatuation had reached a dangerous point, and they decided to act. In those days, when parents decided to act, it always meant that they selected a suitable man, at least a man who suited them, and informed their obedient daughter of the fact. The girl cried and buried her face in the cushion, the usual procedure in cases of unhappy love. But that helped little, and the preparations were going on briskly for the great day. The man she was to marry was a native countryman, a man of high position in society, a rich man with family connections and traditions. She hated the man and loved the major even more passionately. She pleaded and wept in vain. What would become of the world if girls should be disobedient to their parents? The day was appointed, and the marriage feast was to take place within a few days of the announcement. The girl could not rebel openly, but she did rebel inwardly, and to show her disdain and contempt for her future lord and master, she sent word to the major by a trusted servant girl to visit her in her room the night before the marriage ceremony was to take place, and that she would hang a white handkerchief on her windowsill to indicate that all was well, and he might climb through her window into her chamber. "It is my desperation that drives me to this act," she wrote, "an act my maidenly sense of purity forbade to consider before. It is to you I want to offer myself, and to you only." The day arrived, but the sun had not set. Soon after sunset, however, a messenger arrived from the general commanding the corps to say that the regiment would march immediately towards Genoa to support the left flank of the Divardi Brigade against advancing cavalry. Immediately! Just that day, just at that hour, when a hopeless dream, a burning desire was about to be consummated, just that night, when the door of happiness would have opened, only to be closed again forever after. To miss an assignation of this kind, and to march to another of such different nature, where they distribute everything but kisses and love. But why immediately? Why not in the morning, or early after midnight? Is it so urgent to meet the enemy, to kill, and to be killed by cold steel? Couldn't it be postponed a day, a few hours? Couldn't the departure be postponed by preparations just for a few hours, on some pretext or other? What if the messenger had been delayed and delivered the order 6 hours later? Could not a messenger be delayed by enemy patrols, by bad roads, by detours he had to make? Who could ever blame him for being late at the appointment? Passion and sense of duty and honor fought a violent battle within his soul, but just for a fleeting moment. It might cost the lives of many of his comrades. It might offer unlimited strategic advantages to the enemy. It might cost us the war. Obey, soldier, obey. There was no alternative. You have to march. He gave orders, and when the first stars appeared in the sky, the regiment was in the saddle and riding through the town. The major gave his orders to the subalterns. Larks were singing among the lilac bushes under his sweetheart's window as they neared the house. The bugle was silent as they passed the mansion. The major feared lest it should frighten the lark away from under her windows. Why not let her enjoy that, at least as long as she would be waiting in vain for the coming of her lover? There was the white handkerchief sadly hanging from the windowsill, but even the breeze was absent, and it dangled lifelessly, mournfully in the heat. The regiment marched out of the sleeping town in silence. "Forward, boys, let us hurry." From the top of the hill just outside the town he looked back and saw the white handkerchief where the hot breeze stirred it somewhat more lively, and it waved like a farewell sigh. The monotonous tramp of the horses was the only sound audible. The enemy was far off yet, and soon the town lay far behind. The major did not miss his second assignation. He was there on the minute, and if he had dallied but half an hour, the left wing of the brigade would have been outflanked, and disaster would have followed. It was a passionate rendezvous, as between sweethearts who have been long waiting to embrace. The major reaped his reward by the victory of his men, but paid for it with his own life. He fell on the battlefield, but had saved his honor. And in the town the handkerchief was still dangling in the breeze when the major's body was brought back for burial. And we, who knew of it, said to each other, "There! A girl's honor was also saved by a miracle." British ghost story author Ronald Chetwynd Hayes was born in London in 1919. Before his death in 2001, he authored more than 10 novels, edited over 20 anthologies, and published more than 200 short stories. Known as Britain's Prince of Chill, he received the Bram Stoker Award for Lifetime Achievement in 1988 and the British Fantasy Society Special Award in 1989. His most popular book, The Monster Club, was made into a motion picture starring Vincent Price and John Carradine. Here is The Limping Ghost by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Mother said Brian was not to play with matches, and of course he did, setting light to the old summer house so that Father had to put the fire out with the garden hose. Father maintained that Brian should be spanked, but Mother would not let him, stating with cool simplicity that words were more powerful than blows. "Well, that's all very well," Father grumbled, "but one day..." "He's only 7," Mother pointed out. "And we must reason with him. It's not as though any real damage was done." Julia went out to look at the summer house, and truly the damage was negligible. The doorsteps were slightly scorched, but this added to the old-world, time-beating appearance of the ancient building. When she came back to the house, Mother was explaining to Brian the virtues and evils of fire. "The fire keeps us warm. It cooks our food and is nice to look at."
"Makes pretty pictures," Brian stated. "Lots of mountains and valleys."
"Yes," Mother agreed, "and therefore fire is a good friend. But when you set light to the summer house, then it was a bad enemy.
You, all of us, could have been burnt to death."
"Death. Death."
Brian repeated the words with some satisfaction.
"What is death?"
Mother frowned, then proceeded to choose her words with care.
"The body. Your arms and legs become still, and you can't use your body anymore. You become like Mr. Miss One."
Brian grinned with impish delight.
"I'd like to be Mr. Miss One."
Mother took the small boy into her arms and shook her beautiful head so that the fair curls danced like corn in sunlight.
"No. No, my darling, no, you wouldn't like being Mr. Miss One."
Julia came down late for dinner, for she had fallen asleep in her room and dreamt a strange dream. It seemed that she had been in the drawing room when Mr. Miss One entered. He had limped across the room and sank down beside her on the sofa. And for the first time he seemed to know she was present. He stared straight at her and looked so very, very sad that when she awoke, tears were rolling down her cheeks.
"You look pale," Mother remarked.
"And your eyes are red. I hope you aren't sickening or something."
Julia said,
"No,"
then seated herself opposite Brian, who had made a face and poked his tongue out.
"Behave yourself," Father warned. "And Julia, you're not to tease him."
"I didn't,"
Julia began to protest, but Mother said, "You're not to answer your father back." She hung her head and fought back the scalding tears. The terrible injustice was a burning pain, and she felt shut out, unwanted. Brian was a child, a doll for her parents to pet. She was 16, tall, awkward, not particularly pretty, which meant being unloved, isolated, scolded, who knows, perhaps hated.
"Julia, sit up," Mother continued with a sharp voice. "Don't slouch. Heavens above, when I was your age, I was as straight as a larch. Really, I can't imagine who you take after."
"Listen to your mother," Father ordered, smiling at Brian, whose mouth was smeared with custard. "She is talking for your own good." They might have been talking to a stranger or casting words at a statue. Her very presence, every action, provoked a series of stock phrases. She moved in her chair.
"Don't fidget," Mother snapped.
"For heaven's sake, sit still," said Father. Julia got up and ran from the room.
"Oh, no," Mother exclaimed. "Not another fit of the sulks."
"She'll get over it," Father pronounced. The garden dozed under the afternoon sun, while bees and bluebottles hummed with contentment in the heat. Julia lay back in a deck chair and basked in a lake of misery, wallowing in the melancholy stream of her self-pity.
"I wish I could die. Death is like a beautiful woman in a gray robe who closes our eyes with gentle fingers, then wipes the slate of memory clean."
She decided this was a noble thought, and really, she was quite definitely a genius, which explained why everyone was so unkind.
"I am different," she told herself, and at once felt much more cheerful. "I think on a much higher plane. Mother is so stupid, afraid to smile in case she makes a line on her face. And as for Father, he's an echo of nothing. Brian is horrible, spoilt little beast, but I'm a genius."
Having reached this satisfactory conclusion, she was about to rise when Mr. Miss One entered the garden. He was carrying a hoe, and walking over to one of the flower beds, he began to turn the soil, or rather gave the appearance of doing so, for Julia knew that not even a single stone would be disturbed. She crept up to him like a puppy approaching its master, uncertain of its reception. She stopped some 3 feet from him and sank down on the grass, gazing up into his face. He was so beautiful. There was no other word to describe that kind, sensitive face. Mother was always a little frightened of Mr. Miss One, saying that though he appeared harmless, nevertheless he wasn't natural. Father regarded him in much the same way, as if he were a stray cat that had refused to be dislodged. "We must be mad to live in a house with a bally ghost," he had once protested. "Never know when the damn thing is going to pop up." This attitude, of course, only confirmed their mundane, unimaginative outlook and showed up Julia's exceptional powers of perception. Mr. Miss One was beautiful, kind, and must have been long ago a remarkable person. Julia had no evidence to support this theory, for Mr. Miss One never spoke, was apparently oblivious of their presence, and only performed little, non-productive chores, strolling aimlessly through the house or garden. Furthermore, Mr. Miss One was not young, possibly as old as Julia's father, for his black hair was flecked with gray, and there were tired lines around his eyes and mouth. But these signs of age enhanced his beauty, making him a strange, exciting figure, combining the attributes of father and lover. Now he stood upright, leaning upon the hoe, and stared thoughtfully back at the house.
"Mr. Miss One," Julia whispered, "who are you? I want to know so much. How long ago did you live? When did you die? And why do you haunt the house and garden?" "Haunt? That's a funny word. It sounds frightening, and you don't frighten me at all."
Mr. Miswan returned to his work and continued to turn soil that never moved.
"Father says you don't exist, but are only a time image of someone who lived here years and years ago." "That's nonsense. I could not fall in love with a shadow or dream about a patch of colored air."
"Julia!"
Mother was standing in the doorway, and her voice held an angry, fearful tone.
"Julia, come here at once."
Reluctantly she rose and left Mr. Miswan to his ghostly gardening, willing herself not to look back. Mother slapped her bare arm, a punishment that had been applied in her childhood.
"I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, you're not to go near that thing. It's not healthy. It ought to be exorcised or something."
"Exorcised,"
Julia corrected.
"And don't answer me back. I think sometimes you're a little mad. Go to your room and don't come down till I say so."
From her bedroom window, Julia watched Mr. Miswan. He was pushing a ghostly lawnmower over the lawn, limping laboriously in its wake, seemingly oblivious that no grass leapt into the box and that the whirring blades made no sound.
"I expect he was killed in the war," Julia thought, as he disappeared behind a rhododendron bush.
She waited for him to reappear, but the garden remained empty, and when, presently, the setting sun sent long tree shadows across the grass, she knew, for the time being at least, the play was over.
"I thought we might run down to the coast today,"
Father announced over the breakfast table. "Good idea."
Mother nodded her agreement.
"Julia, sit up, child. Don't slouch."
"Listen to your mother," Father advised.
"Yes, a breath of sea air will do us all good. Brian will enjoy it. Won't you, old fellow?"
"Yes,"
Brian nodded vigorously.
"Throw stones at seagulls."
Both fond parents laughed softly, and Mother admonished gently,
"You mustn't throw stones at dicky birds."
"Why?"
"Because..."
For once, Mother seemed lost for an explanation, and it was left to Father to express an opinion.
"Because it's not nice."
"We won't go," Julia thought. "We never go. Something will happen to stop us."
But preparations went on after breakfast. Mother packed a hamper, and Brian produced a colored bucket and wooden spade from the attic, while Julia was instructed to brighten up and look cheerful for a change.
"Maybe we will go this time,"
she whispered, putting on her best summer dress with polka dots.
"Perhaps nothing will happen to stop us."
The feeling of optimism grew as the entire family walked round the house to the garage, Father carrying the hamper, Mother fanning herself with a silk handkerchief, and Brian kicking the loose gravel. Father opened the garage door, took one step forward, then stopped.
"Damnation hell!" he swore. "This really is too much."
Mr. Miswan was cleaning the car.
A bright yellow duster whisked over the dust that remained undisturbed. White liquid from a green tin was sprayed onto the bonnet, but somehow never reached its surface. Mr. Miswan rubbed the chrome work vigorously, but there was no sign that this labor was to be rewarded. The dull bloom persisted, and at times he appeared to be polishing the empty space on either side of the bonnet, thereby suggesting to Julia's watchful eye that another, much larger car was the object of his ministrations.
"What the hell do we do?" asked Father.
"Well," Mother backed away. "I, for one, am staying at home. Nothing on earth will get me in that car. Heavens above, he might come with us."
"We shouldn't allow it to dominate our lives,"
Father protested, but without much conviction. "I mean to say, it's only a damn time image. Doesn't really exist, you know."
"Thank you very much, but it's got too much life for me."
Mother began to walk back towards the house.
"Honestly, if you were any sort of man, you would get rid of it."
What am I supposed to do?
Father was almost running to keep up with her.
I can't kick it. There's nothing solid for me to get grips with. I do think, my dear, that you're being a little unreasonable.
Mother grunted, fanning herself vigorously. Then she turned on Julia.
It's all your fault. You encouraged it.
I...
Julia tried to defend herself, but a sense of guilt paralyzed her tongue.
You ought to be ashamed.
Father glared, wiping his forehead with his top pocket, never to be used handkerchief.
You've no right to encourage it, spoiling our day out, upsetting your mother, and depriving your little brother of good sea air.
Mother flopped down into a deck chair, where she continued to wave her handkerchief back and forth.
Yesterday evening I caught her at it. Talking to it she was, lying there on the grass, and talking to it. She's mad. Heavens above knows who she takes after. Certainly my family were sane enough. I don't know what's to become of us.
We could move,
Father suggested.
And to where?
Mother sat up and put away her handkerchief.
Who would buy a house with a ghost, an active ghost?
And where would we get another house that's so secluded and off the beaten track? You know I must have solitude, peace, and quiet.
Perhaps it will go away,
Father said after a short silence.
They do, you know. The atmosphere sort of dispels after a bit.
Not while that girl encourages it,
Mother stated. Not while she moons around it like a lovesick puppy.
Keep away from it,
warned Father.
Brian punched her thigh with his small fist.
Keep away from it.
Days passed without an appearance from Mr. Miss One. Julia wondered if her mother's anger had built a wall through which he could not pass, and mourned for him as though for a loved friend who had recently died. Sometimes, when she escaped from the vigilance of her parents, she went looking for him, roamed the garden, or suddenly opened a door, hoping to see him leaning against the mantelpiece or lounging in a chair. But he had become a shadow that flees before sunlight. Even Father commented on his non-appearance.
6 days now, and we haven't seen hair or hide of it.
What did I tell you? The atmosphere has dispelled.
Stuff and nonsense,
Mother snapped.
Atmosphere indeed. Lack of encouragement, more likely. I've been keeping an eye on someone I could touch with a very small stick.
3 pair of eyes turned in Julia's direction, and she blushed. Brian kicked her ankle under the table.
Keep away from it. I am of the opinion,
Mother went on,
that he must have been a bad character. I mean to say, respectable people don't go haunting places after they're dead. They go to wherever they're supposed to go, and don't keep traipsing about making a nuisance of themselves. He probably murdered someone and can't rest.
All Julia's reticence, her lifelong submission to her parents' opinions, disappeared in a flood of righteous anger. A part of her looked on and listened with profound astonishment to the torrent of words that poured out of her mouth.
He was not bad. I know it. He was sad, and that's why he walks. I know. Perhaps once he was happy here. Or maybe it's sadness that chains him to this house. You're bad, small, stupid, and you've driven him away. I'll never forgive you, ever.
Mother was so shocked that for a while she was incapable of speech. Father stared at the rebel with dilated eyes. Finally, Mother's tongue renewed its natural function.
I always said the girl was mad, and at last I have proof. I feel quite faint. Heavens, did you see her eyes? Really, Henry, are you just going to sit there while she insults us? Do something.
What?
Yes.
Father rose as though he were about to deliver a speech. That's no way to talk to your parents, particularly your mother.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
Mother pointed with dramatic emphasis towards the door.
Get out! Go on, go to your room, and I don't care if I never see your face again.
But the earthquake was still erupting, and Julia shouted back, her brain a red cavern of pain.
I hate you! Hate! Hate!
Mother screamed and fell back in her chair, while Father so far forgot himself as to stamp his foot.
How dare you speak to your mother like that? Go to your room.
Remorse flooded her being, and she craved forgiveness like a soul in torment.
I didn't mean it. Please.
But Father had eyes and ears only for Mother, who was gasping and writhing in a most alarming fashion. Brian watched the ingrate with joyous excitement. Julia ran to her room. She flung herself face down on the bed and sobbed soundlessly, her slender shoulders shaking, her long fingers clutching the bedclothes. Presently the storm abated and she became still. Her eyes opened and her sixth sense sent out invisible fingers. All at once, she knew. She sat up and spun round. Mr. Miss One was standing in the recess by the side of the fireplace. As usual, he was busy, but it took some minutes for her to understand what he was doing. A hand drill. He appeared to be making holes in the wall, although, of course, the pink-flowered pattern wallpaper remained unmarked. Julia got up and walked cautiously towards him, joy blended with curiosity. He slipped little cylinders of fiber into the wall, then drove screws into the invisible holes. Light illuminated the darkness of Julia's ignorance.
He's fitting a bookshelf. How sweet.
She moved a little nearer so as to observe his actions with more clarity. His face was a study in concentration. The teeth were clenched, the muscles round the mouth taut, and once, when the screwdriver slipped, his lips parted as though mouthing a silent curse. She spoke her thoughts aloud, even as a penitent unburdens his soul to an invisible priest.
Mother is right. I shouldn't be thinking of you all the time. Look at you, fixing a shelf that probably moldered away years ago. If only I could talk to you, hear your voice most of all, make you realize I exist.
Mr. Miss One lifted the formica-covered shelf and fitted it into position. It immediately disappeared, but he continued to work, seemingly content that all was well.
You are more real to me than mother or father, and I feel I ought to tell you all manner of things. But there is no point when you ignore me. Is there no way I can reach you?
Mr. Miss One took up a hammer and began to tap the wall. Julia moved one step nearer. She could see a small cut on his chin.
You cut yourself shaving. How long ago did that happen? 10, 20, 30 years ago? Oh, you must know I am here. Can't you feel something? A coldness, an awareness. Surely there must be something. The certainty that you are not alone, the urge to look back over one shoulder. Look at me. Look, turn your head. You must. Must.
The hammer struck Mr. Miss One's thumb and he swore.
Blast!
The solitary word exploded across the room and shattered the silence, making Julia shrink back. She retreated to the opposite wall, pressed her shoulders against its unrelenting surface and watched him. He dropped the hammer, which fell to the floor with a resounding crash, sucked the afflicted thumb, then stared in Julia's direction. For a period of 5 seconds he was a statue, a frozen effigy of a man. Then his mouth popped open, the hand dropped away, and his eyes were blue mirrors reflecting astonishment, disbelief, fear.
You can see me!
Julia's joyous cry ran out, and she took 2 steps forward to find he had vanished, man, hammer, plus the assortment of tools disappeared, and Julia was left banging her fist against the recess wall. Her voice rang out in a shriek of despair. Why? Why? Mother, father, even the carefully tutored Brian, treated her to the silence reserved for the outcast. Some speech was unavoidable, but this was delivered in ice-coated voices with impeccable politeness. "Will you kindly pass the salt?" Mother requested on one occasion. "If it's not too much trouble." Father appeared to be applying the sanctions with some reluctance, but he was forced to obey a higher authority. "More tea?" His hand was on the teapot. Then he remembered his ordained line of conduct and pushed it towards her.
"Help yourself."
Brian was more direct.
"I mustn't talk to you."
This isolationist treatment created comfort when it was designed to produce misery. She was no longer the target for the admonishing barbs, corrected slaps, or stinging words. She could fidget, sulk, slouch, or spend hours in her room without a single rebuke, although on occasion Mother was clearly sorely provoked, and once or twice her silence policy almost collapsed. Free from supervision, she was able to continue her pursuit of Mr. Miss One, but once again he seemed to have gone into hiding. The hum and roar of speeding cars drifted across the sleeping meadows. The roar of an overhead jet could be heard above the wind in the trees. Yet the living had no place in Julia's heart, or, for that matter, in any place in the house or garden. Of late, a dream had taken root in her imagination. Now it dominated her waking and sleeping life. The seed had first been sown when she saw Mr. Miss One cleaning his car. "Suppose," whispered her imagination, "you were to get into the car and let Mr. Miss One drive you out into the world, let him rescue you, carry you off, and never, never come back." The voice of reason, a nasty, insinuating whisper, interrupted with, "But he is dead. A ghost." Reason was hoist by its own petard. "If he is dead, if he is a ghost, then there is only one way which I can join him." The twin daggers of shock and horror became blunt as the dream grew. It was the solution to all problems. The key to open the door to Mr. Miss One. She began to consider ways and means. Poison! She had no means of obtaining any. Cut her throat, slash her wrists. She shied away from such grim prospects like a horse from a snake. Rope. Hanging. That would be easy and should not be too painful. There was a length of plastic clothesline in the garage and a convenient beam. If she jumped from the car roof, the leap would be completed in the space of a single heartbeat. It was all so very simple, and Julia wondered why she had not thought of it before. She began to make her plans. From 2 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon would be best, for it was then that the family took their after-lunch nap. Mother undressed and went to bed. Father, weather permitting, stretched himself out on a garden hammock, or if wind or rain confined him to the house, he lay prostrate on the sitting-room sofa. Brian slept anywhere. Like an animal, he shut off his consciousness whenever his elders set the example. Without doubt, the time to die was between 2 and 4 in the afternoon. The situation was somewhat complicated by Mother suddenly relaxing her rule of silence and making overtures for peace. She actually smiled and said sweetly, "Good morning, dear," before cracking her breakfast egg. "You're looking quite pretty this morning," she went on to remark, an obvious untruth that suggested a desire to please. Julia was near despair. How could one die with an easy conscience when the enemy spiked their own guns and flew the white flag? Fortunately, Mother had a relapse with a cutting remark. "Prettiness without grace is like a wreath without flowers. and instantly Julia's resolve became a determination. She would die when the sun was high, take the fatal step in full daylight, and refuse to be diverted by smile or insult. However, she made one last effort to contact Mr. Miss One, creeping from room to room and searching the garden, praying that he might appear and acknowledge her existence with a smile, for she could not deny the unpalatable fact that on one occasion, when Mr. Miss One had seen her in the bedroom, his reaction had been one of fear. At least this established him as an intelligent personality, instead of the mindless time image Father so glibly dismissed. But it was, to say the least, a little disconcerting to know one's appearance inspired fear in a ghost. Of course, once she had assumed the same status, there would be no reason for him to fear her at all. Like would appeal to like. She waited with burning impatience for the hour of two. At the lunch table, all signs indicated that normality had returned. "Don't slouch," ordered Mother. "Sit upright," Father chimed in. "Try to be more like your mother." Brian displayed signs of budding brilliance.
"You're not pretty. You're not ugly. You're pretty ugly."
The fond parents smiled. "He takes after me," pronounced Mother.
"I could always turn a phrase."
Julia's impatience to be gone grew and destroyed her last lingering doubts. Father had intended to take his nap in the garden, but just before 2 o'clock, the first cold needles of rain began to fall, so he retreated to the sitting room and was soon prostrate on the sofa. Mother climbed the stairs, the bedroom door slammed, and Julia murmured an inaudible goodbye. Brian lay down on the dining room hearthrug and appeared to fall asleep, but Julia wondered if this was not a pretense put on for her benefit. Fortunately, the door had a key in the lock, so she turned it before leaving the house. A rising wind drove a curtain of rain across the lawn. It forced proud trees to bend their heads in submission and turned Julia's dress into a wet shroud. She ran for the garage, water splashing up her legs, dripping down her nose and chin, but it did not feel cold or even wet, and she marveled at the sense of well-being. The garage doors were open, and there was no time to consider why this was so, for there, standing in the gloomy interior, was a large red car. Julia stood within the entrance and stared at this stranger with wide-eyed astonishment. There should have been an ancient black family Austin. Instead, a sleek, rather vicious-looking red monster occupied the entire floor. A creation of highly polished red enamel, gleaming chromework, black tires, and bulging mudguards. It seemed to be a thing of latent power, just waiting for the right finger to touch a switch, to send it hurling along straight roads, across the barriers of time and space, into a million tomorrows. The offside door was open, and Julia, her plans for self-destruction forgotten, slid onto the red plastic-covered seat and feasted her eyes on the complicated switchboard, the black steering wheel, the gleaming gear levers. Curiosity turned to wonderment, then ripened into pure joy. A ghost car! It must be, of course. This was the vehicle Mr. Miss One had been cleaning. Only then it was invisible, due undoubtedly to the base thoughts of Mother, Father, and that little beast Brian. Now she could see it, feel it, and heavens be praised, actually smell it. This must be the result of suffering, loving him with all her being. She giggled, clasped her hands, and waited with joyous anticipation. Mr. Miss One entered the garage limping, carrying a small overnight bag. He was plainly prepared for a journey. A terrible fear struck Julia.
"Please don't make it all disappear. Let me go with him, wherever he goes, anywhere at all."
He opened the right-hand door, slung his bag on the back seat, then climbed in. He closed the door, turned a key on the switchboard, and the engine roared with instant pulsating life.
"Don't let it all disappear. Let me go with him."
The car slid out of the garage. The garden and house swept by the windows, and Julia spared a thought for Mother, Father, and Brian, blissfully asleep, unaware that the despised one was passing out of their lives forever.
"It's happening! I'm going out! At last! Oh, merciful God, going out!"
The main gates, new, glossy with black paint, were open, and Mr. Miss One swung the car out onto a country road. They were away at last, speeding along under an arcade of trees, flashing by meadows, snarling past lovely red-bricked houses, while sunscreen wipers made neat half-moons in the driving rain. Mr. Miss One suddenly reached over and opened a narrow flap on the switchboard. His hand was a bare inch from Julia's breast, and she wanted to touch it, clasp the strong fingers, but was afraid that this wonderful dream might dispel. He took out a packet of cigarettes, adroitly popped one into his mouth, then replaced the carton and shut the flap. He lit the cigarette with a strange contraption from a switchboard, then inhaled, letting the smoke trickle down through his nose. By the time they had reached the main bypass, the novelty was wearing off, and Julia permitted herself a measure of confidence. The dream, if such it was, displayed no signs of breaking down. The car was solid. She could feel the seat beneath her, hear the muted roar of the engine, smell the smoke from Mr. Miss One's cigarette, see the road sliding away under the car wheels. The bypass was straight, a gray ribbon that stretched out into infinity as their speed built up. 60, 70, 80 miles an hour. Julia watched the needle climb on the speedometer. Then she turned her head and looked at Mr. Miss One. Poor ghost, entirely oblivious in his ghost car, he did not know she was there. How was she to declare her presence and break through the wall that still separated them? She began to talk, spilling out her thoughts in a jumble of low-spoken words.
"Mr. Miss One, I'm sorry I don't know your real name, but Brian, the horrible little beast, first called you Mr. Miss One because of your limp. You sort of miss a step. Please, don't think it's meant unkindly, at least by me. In fact, the limp adds to your appearance, makes you more romantic."
"I guess that sounds silly, but I am silly. I can't help it. I've been in love with you ever since that day when you first walked across the dining room and Mother went screaming under the table. She did look funny. I remember you took something we couldn't see from the sideboard, then disappeared by the kitchen door. Can't you see, or at least hear me?" It might have been imagination, but Mr. Miss One did appear to be a little uneasy. He slid down the window to throw away his half-consumed cigarette. Julia sighed.
"I wonder where we are going. Is this your world? Are the people out there wandering shadows left over from yesteryear? Or are we racing invisible through today? Please, try to see me."
She could see his left wrist. His jacket sleeve had slid down, and the wrist was bare. Suntanned, muscular, covered with fine hair. It was also covered with goose pimples. She gasped, then gave a little cry.
"Oh, you're cold! My poor darling, you're cold!"
She had not meant to touch him, not yet, but there was no controlling the automatic impulse. Her hand flew to his wrist. For a brief moment, she touched warm flesh. Actually, felt the fast beating pulse. Then the car swerved, and Mr. Miss One jerked his head round and stared straight at her. His face was a mask of pure, blood-chilling terror, and his mouth opened as he screamed.
His hands clawed at the steering wheel as though some part of his brain were trying to right the skid, and the scream erupted into isolated words like black rocks crushing through a sheet of ice. Dead! Family! Burnt! Dead! 50 years! Dead! 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 The screech of tortured rubber mingled with the screaming words. Outside, the gray road was spinning round and round. A black shape came hurtling through the rain. There was a mighty, soul-uprooting crash. Then, for a brief second, nothing. A heartbeat of total oblivion. Julia was standing by the roadside watching the car burn. Like a giant red beetle, it lay on its back, while beautiful scarlet flames rose from its corpse like poppies from a long-filled grave. The red enamel bubbled and drooled down the seething metal as blood tears from the eyes of a dying man. And somewhere in the heart of the shrieking inferno, something moved. Sound flickered, then ceased. Cars drew up and the occupants climbed out. Mouths open, faces assumed expressions of horror, shock, or morbid excitement. But they were so many silent, pathetic ghosts. Julia turned and walked away. Home was but a few steps away. Over the grass verge, through a hedge, under some trees, and there were the gates. Broken, rusty. One had lost a hinge and was reeling like a drunken man. Once back in the garden, sound returned. Birds sang. Bees hummed, and the sun peeped through a broken cloud bank, making the rain-coated flowers glisten like colored fragments. Julia opened the front door and made her way to the dining room. The family was seated round the table, which was laid for tea. "At last," exclaimed Mother. "I called until my voice was hoarse. Honestly, I don't know who you think you are." "It's really too bad," Father echoed. "Your mother was nearly out of her mind. Where have you been?" Julia did not answer, but sank down staring blankly at the tablecloth. Brian kicked her ankle.
"You locked me in."
"I ask you," Mother addressed the ceiling, "is that the action of a rational person, locking your little brother in the dining room? Heavens above knows what might have happened." "Well, don't just sit there. We are waiting for an explanation."
"Answer your mother," Father instructed. Julia took a deep breath.
We're dead. All of us. Dead." The first shadows of night crept in through the long French window, and the silence was coated with the dust of long dead time. Julia looked up. They were watching her with blank, pale faces.
"Don't you understand? We're dead. We died 50 years ago in a fire. Brian did it. He set light to the bedroom curtains. The whole place went up in fire and smoke."
The ticking of the mantelpiece clock seemed to grow louder. Brian stirred in his chair with a frantic denial.
"I didn't."
"You did."
Julia turned on him savagely.
"You were told not to play with matches. It was you. You burnt us all to death."
"I didn't. I didn't."
He hammered the table with his small clenched fist while tears ran down his cheeks, then rose and ran to Father, who put his arms around the shaking body.
"Make her stop. I didn't. I didn't play with matches."
"It's all right,"
Father whispered.
"It's all right. Your sister isn't well."
Mother could not speak, could only stare at Julia with wide-open eyes. Occasionally, she shook her head as though in disbelief.
"Please," Julia pleaded, "try to understand. We are all dead. Mr. Miss One was the living. We are ghosts."
"Go to your room, dear."
Father's voice was unexpectedly gentle. Go to bed like a little girl. We'll look after you. Don't worry.
Yes, Mother spoke at last. Please forgive me. I never knew. I'll never say a cross word again. Ever.
Julia rose very slowly, and as she did so, understanding exploded in her brain.
You think I'm mad?
Mother shuddered, and Father shook his head firmly.
No, no, of course not, dear. Just tired. Ill, maybe, but not mad. Dear God, not mad.
Julia fled before their naked terror, and, as always, took refuge in her room. She lay upon the bed and stared up at the ceiling, gradually allowing the veil to fall from the awful face of truth. She could never be happy again. She knew. Knowledge was brutal. Knowledge destroyed the comforting curtain of doubt. Father, clearly at ease, brought her some food on a tray. Talked much too quickly of the healing virtues of sleep, plenty of good food, peace of mind, then departed. Julia heard the key turn in the lock. Presently she sat by the window and watched the sun put the garden to bed. Shadows lengthened, flowers folded their petals, trees hung their heads, and the evening breeze went dancing across the lawn. For a while there was a great healing peace. Then a dark shape limped up the drive. At first Julia thought it might be Father, but as it drew nearer she saw the black, charred face. The hands were shriveled, twisted. Patches of white bone gleamed through the gaping, roasted flesh. Eyes still glittered in the naked skull, and they stared up at Julia's window. Julia tried to scream, but her vocal cords refused to function. The most she could make was a hoarse croaking sound. But out of the heart of her all-demanding terror, a single rational thought ran across her brain like a ribbon of fire.
Is this how I appear to him?
All that remained of Mr. Miss One limped up the front steps and disappeared from view. Julia knew her prayer had been answered. She would never be parted from him again.
This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts.
When someone you know is struggling with vision loss, it can be challenging. But the Mass Commission for the Blind is here to help. We'll connect them to resources that will help them plan for the future with new skills and assistive technology. Find out if they're eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.